Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Administrative Law and Regulation Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, July 2, 2014, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call. Today, our telephone will be discussing the new book, Is Administrative Law Unlawful? By author Philip Hamburger. I am Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion on our telephone today are those of the experts on the call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We are happy to welcome to today's call two experts, including the author of the provocatively titled book, Is Administrative Law Unlawful?, Professor Philip A. Hamburger. He is the Maurice and Hilda Friedman Professor of Law at Columbia Law School, and his book, a link to his book, I should say, was provided in the notice of today's call. It's also available, the link is, on the Federalist Society's website, so I urge you to check that out. We also welcome back to today's call, Adam J. White. He is counsel at Boyd & Gray & Associates right here in Washington, D.C. We're going to proceed a little differently than we sometimes will. We're going to have Adam White interview, essentially, Professor Hamburger. And so with that, I am going to turn things over to Adam White.
Thanks, Dean. Hello, everybody. As Dean mentioned on the call, Philip teaches at Columbia Law School. He's also a widely known and read scholar, a variety of law review articles, but also several very well-regarded books, including Separation of Church and State and Law and Judicial Duty. And again, we're here to discuss his latest book, out last month from Chicago, titled Is Administrative Law Unlawful? So, Philip, let's just begin with the basic question. What would you, if your readers or your audience could come away from your book, bring with them a single overarching point or theme or lesson, what would it be?
Well, thank you, Adam. That is actually suggested by the title, isn't it? Is administrative law unlawful? And my answer is yes. To be more specific, my fear is that administrative power, I don't really like to call it administrative law, it really should just be called power. Administrative power is really a sort of extra legal power. You know, when you think about what the Constitution authorizes, it authorizes the government to bind us, to constrain us through edicts that are statutes or other forms of law and the decisions of the courts of law. And in that way, in our government, we're bound by law or through law. And administrative power seems to be something rather different. Even when it's authorized by law, it's binding us through rules and adjudications that are not statutes, that are not acts of courts. And in that sense, it's a sort of extra legal power. It's binding us not through law, but by other means. So the goal of the book overall is to get people to reconceptualize administrative power. The very label administrative law or power is misleading. What this really is extra legal power. And once one understands that, one can begin to see all sorts of constitutional questions afresh.
Well, thanks, Philip. Now, you touched on the fact that you prefer to speak of this in terms of administrative power rather than administrative law, and that's a point that comes across very clearly in your book. But on the question of administrative power, I was wondering if we could flesh this out a little bit. In legal debates in recent years, especially among federal society, there's been no shortage of debate over executive power. And I'm just curious, what's the difference, if any, between administrative power and executive power, as you see it? And where does all this come from?
Right. So executive power under the U.S. Constitution is actually very broad, and nothing in my book is aimed at diminishing lawful executive power. The executive has the power of exerting force on behalf of the U.S. government, and that can come in all sorts of forms. There's the force that's exercised to carry out the laws and the judgments of courts. There's the force the government uses in distributing benefits. It sends benefits to all of us, sometimes too many perhaps, but it's a lawful exercise of power. And it also exerts coercion against non-subjects, not through law, but through military force or things akin to it. And my book doesn't question any of this. So there's a whole host of executive range of executive power that can come under the general rubric of force that seems to me perfectly legitimate. It's authorized by the Constitution and is not in doubt here. The problem with extra legal power is that it's a power, it's a legislative power or judicial power, and particularly a binding legislative and judicial power that shifted from Congress or the courts to the executive or even to private bodies. And this is extra legal in the sense that it binds not through the law but outside it. So there's a broad, one of actually the great efforts in my book that took me the greatest amount of time was to lay out actually the breadth of executive power that is not impinged upon at all by the argument that administrative power, extra legal power, is unconstitutional. But you had a second question, didn't you, about where all this comes from?
That's right. Your book walks back through the history of Henry VIII, James I, and II, Charles II. It's a very interesting historical read and something that administrative law texts tend not to begin with. And I was wondering if you could just give listeners an introductory description of where all this comes from.
Sure. The history turns out to be very important. If you think about the justifications of administrative power, the justification basically is this is a very modern power developed to meet the practical needs of a modern society. In that sense, the power is necessary and pragmatic, and it doesn't have an old history because it's an expression of a very modernity in the complexity of our society. And from that point of view, the sociological argument is essentially, don't fight modernity. And the constitutional argument is, well, this developed all after the Constitution, perhaps in 1887 with the Interstate Commerce Act, and increasingly thereafter in the 20th century. And it therefore seems not only anti-modern, but silly to suggest that this is unconstitutional, because the Constitution couldn't have anticipated this power. It's a product of modernity, everything that happened after the Constitution. But it turns out this is just wrong. And everyone once knew this. In the 19th century, this was widely understood, that this is not the history of administrative power. Administrative power actually revives what used to be known as prerogative power, the power of kings to bind their subjects not through law or the courts of law, but rather through extra legal means. In fact, the term extra legal that I use is a medieval term for what was then was prerogative, or we would call administrative power, the power of the king to act, to bind people, to call them to his courts or to impose rules on them, not through law, but through these other rules and other adjudications. And this is constitutionally interesting history because it reveals then that constitutional law actually developed precisely in order to defeat this extra legal power. Constitutional law develops in 17th century England and then 18th century America precisely to cut off extra legal power. And it cut off the extra legal lawmaking, let's say in the Star Chamber or the Court of High Commission and other commissions, and to cut off adjudications that were not in the courts of law. And it therefore actually turns out that much of the Constitution is aimed at this power. Nonetheless, by calling administrative law modern, by taking the short-term history of it and hiding the past in prerogative power, it becomes possible for people to justify administrative power and to claim that actually, the Constitution didn't address this matter. So the history turns out to be profoundly important as a constitutional matter.
Now, a few times you've referred to administrative power as extra legal. Early in your book, you make the point that you identify three parts of administrative law, or three features of administrative power. The first is that it's extra legal, but then the two others are that it is supra legal and that it's absolute. Would you mind just explaining what you mean by that?
Thanks. Yes. So the basic element here is that it's extra legal, that the government is constraining one not through law but through other mechanisms. But that's not the end of the matter, because if courts are courts of law, if judges are bound to enforce law, what are they meant to do with regulations and administrative interpretations and the like? And the history of this is kings and now presidents always have to turn to extra legal adjudication to enforce their extra legal rules. So this was the problem with James I. James I made all sorts of proclamations and regulations in Star Chamber, and then he had to enforce them. And the courts didn't want to defer to his extra legal lawmaking and interpretation. So he had to fight for the right of prerogative or administrative courts to enforce these regulations and get deference. And that's exactly the situation today. The courts have to be involved. The courts cannot be relied upon to enforce extra-legal lawmaking, so you need extra-legal adjudication. But then what are the courts meant to do when they're confronted with the adjudication, interpretation, regulations out of this extra-legal power? And the answer of James and prior kings was that this extra-legal power was also supra-legal. It was above the law, and the judges therefore had to defer. Now, nowadays, the courts on the whole don't call it super-legal, but they do defer to administrative decision-making, administrative adjudication rules as if it were above the law. So they haven't theorized it as the folks in the past did, but by its nature, this has to be treated as super-legal, this extra-legal power, otherwise the courts would eviscerate it. And then there's the question of consolidated. It's not only extra-legal, it's not only super-legal, but administrative power tends to be consolidated. And this was true amongst medieval kings. When they exert extra-legal power, when they bind people outside the laws made in parliament, they end up, and then enforce them, they end up having a power that is not only the executive power and the legislative power, but also the judicial power, all wrapped up into one. And we've returned to that. We've returned to unspecialized government. Many people think of separation of powers as being a distinctly American doctrine, but actually there's a long history of the specialization of powers in government. And those specialized powers tended to be allocated to different bodies, imperfectly in England, more perfectly in America. But when we have administrative agencies making rules, adjudicating them, and then enforcing them, they're exercising legislative, judicial, and executive power. And this concatenation of powers turns out to be very, very dangerous, because then they can engage in all sorts of extortion against the people they're ruling.
Okay. Now, a few minutes ago, when you were talking about the roots of administrative power, you made a comment that much of the Constitution is aimed at this power, this extra-legal power.
Yeah.
And so, as we move from British history and our common law history to our Constitution, I should ask, did the founders expressly incorporate this into our Constitution? I mean, because as I recall from the Federalist Papers, Hamilton seemed like a very strong proponent of executive power. So is there a gap or a bridge from English history to our own constitutional roots?
Yes, indeed. So let's begin with Hamilton and then get to the bridging and then to the Constitution itself. To begin with Hamilton. Hamilton indeed sought broad congressional and executive power. He was not shy about wanting a lot of power for the new government. But interestingly, he wanted broad lawmaking power in Congress, and he wanted a broad exercise of force in the executive. He did not argue for lawmaking power in the executive or judicial power in the executive. And this becomes clear not only from his actions leading up to the Constitution, but also afterwards when he's Secretary of the Treasury. One of the fun parts of my book has been to trace through the records and archives what Hamilton actually was doing in the Treasury when he becomes Secretary of the Treasury, because he's issuing all sorts of regulations and instructions to customs officers and has to interpret them. And you might think this is administrative power as we know it. But in fact, he's very, very careful to keep it purely within the constitutional realm of executive power. He does claim broad powers as Secretary of the Treasury to interpret for his department. But he never, never claims that his interpretations or those of the comptroller are binding upon the American people. He goes out of his way to ensure that the regulations and interpretations are instructions to officers within their constitutional executive authority, not attempts to bind people through lawmaking and adjudication outside Congress and the courts. So Hamilton's actions are actually very instructive. Now, very good question about how did the English heritage of constitutional responses to prerogative power reach America? American lawyers, if you go through their manuscript notes and their readings, they're deeply imbued with this English history. It seems to them very real. Gordon Wood, I think, has observed the degree to which they feel the history of the struggle against the prerogative to be part of their own history. And in fact, much of the dispute between Parliament and the colonies in the 1760s and 70s is about what we would call administrative power. If you think about how the Stamp Act is enforced and other statutes that the Americans didn't like were enforced, it raises many of these questions of administrative power. So the disputes about general warrants, for example, are about what in effect are administrative warrants. You have actually a judicial warrant in form, but it functions as an administrative warrant, and the Americans reject this. So it does actually lead up to the adoption of a new country and the Constitution. And the Constitution itself, to get to the third point, deals with this very bluntly. Precisely by allocating legislative power to Congress and judicial power to the courts, the Constitution avoids putting this in the executive. Indeed, it only gives executive power to the executive. This is, we can go into more detail on this if you want, but this was understood to be a way of cutting back on prerogative or administrative power. What's more, and here it gets particularly interesting, all of the procedural rights in the Bill of Rights, almost all of them, are designed actually not merely to cut back on what courts do, but at least essentially to cut back on what the executive or anybody else might do. And the history of jury trials and of due process are particularly instructive here. We may assume that the right to a jury is really just about what happens in court, not what happens in the executive. But in fact, the right to a jury is understood by early Americans actually to be aimed at any attempt to exercise judicial power. So, for example, some of the earliest cases involving jury rights in 1780 and 1785 are all about Holmes versus Walton and the 10-pound cases in New Hampshire. They're all about jury rights actually in administrative proceedings, where a jury is denied in a proceeding before Justice of the Peace, or you get a half a jury, a six-person jury. And even when there's an appeal to a court, and you get a jury on appeal from these proceedings, the courts hold that the proceedings are unconstitutional, and indeed the statutes establishing them are unconstitutional, because they're denying a right to a jury. The right to a jury is a right in the first instance, even when you're not in an ordinary court of law. And the right to due process is even clearer. The right to due—it's often said with this smarmy phrase, "Well, in administrative proceedings, you get all the process that is due." Well, due process actually is a history. In 1354 and 1368, the English Parliament adopts the first due process statutes, and they are expressly aimed at administrative or prerogative proceedings, not at what happens in the court. And the Americans knew this history. The history of due process has always been at least as much, perhaps centrally, about limiting what happens outside the courts. And all of this has been overturned by administrative power. We've reverted back to the claims of the king prior to 1354, when he insists that he can offer just the process that's due in his king's council, or let's say in the EPA. This ends up eviscerating much of the Bill of Rights. So we actually need to recover the real meaning of the jury provisions and the due process provision.
Okay, well, in terms of losing the meaning that we need to recover, our conversation has brought us up through the founding era, and your book then traces the arc of history from the founding to modern times by way of, you know, familiar events, the Interstate Commerce Act, the creation of the Interstate Commerce Commission, the New Deal, and in between you have the progressives both at the national level and at state and local governments. And that's a very interesting discussion, but I was just curious if you could briefly walk the readers, or the audience, through the
basic...
Hopefully
they'll be readers.
They should be. It's a good book and worth reading. But would you mind just sketching out this path
right.
brought us to our present situation?
Right. So the history begins to get interesting in the late 19th century. If you think about the broad sweep of constitutional history, the English and Americans cut off prerogative or absolute or extralegal power, whatever you want to call it. They cut it off through constitutional law in England in the 17th century, in America in the 18th century. But extralegal power actually persisted and became remained very, very strong on the continent, particularly in France and Germany. And the Germans in particular develop a systematized vision of administrative power. Whereas they once believed in the personal prerogative of the king in the 18th century, they develop the bureaucratic administrative power of the state. And this gets theorized, amongst others, by Hegel in the 19th century, but also by many administrative law scholars in Germany. Now, that alone doesn't explain how Americans picked this up, but this extralegal power circled back to America through continental, especially German, scholarship. What happened was this. The progressives in the late 19th century tended to view with a certain disgust the hurly-burly politics of representative government. And this was tied into a lot of class and racial prejudice. Woodrow Wilson at one point complains that reformers can't make any headway when you have to persuade a lot of Irishmen, Germans, and Negroes. He's quite blunt at what he's worried about. He thinks you can't persuade a diverse country to go along with progressive elite ideas. And so some of them say they need to have an aristocracy run the country somehow. And then they figure out how to do this in a scientific expertise way based on experts, because thousands upon thousands of Americans end up going to Germany in the late 19th century to study in German universities. And one of the things they study is administrative power. And when these Americans come back, many of them being progressives, realize that they can satisfy their desire to have a more high-toned government that doesn't involve the diversity and rumble and tumble of the representative government by placing power in experts who will, Prussian-style, govern the country through administrative power. And so Woodrow Wilson's lectures on administrative power in the 1880s and 90s are almost entirely cribbed from the Germans. It's one scholar has described it as warmed over German theory. The only deviations he had on the whole were because his German was slightly off, and so he didn't always translate very well. And at Columbia, my own school, at Johns Hopkins, and then increasingly at other schools, you can't teach political theory without going to Germany, and when you study it, even go to the law schools, you pick up the German theory. So a combination of the progressives and Prussian theory gave us administrative power.
Well, Dean, Philip, I have many other questions I'd ask, but this might be a natural point for us to turn over to the audience and see if they have any questions to ask.
Very good. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question for our expert, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for Philip Hamburger, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Once again, the title of his book is Administrative Law Unlawful. It is a Chicago Press book, and it's available on links that we sent around in the notice of today's call, also available through Amazon and the Federal Society's website and all the regular outlets for major books. Adam, we've got four callers with questions so far. We've got over 120 people on the line, so let's take that first question.
Hi, this is Nelson Lund from George Mason Law School. I wonder whether there's a meaningful difference or not between administrative agencies exercising powers clearly delegated to them by the Congress and administrative agencies exercising a very thinly disguised prerogative power of the kind that the Obama administration is becoming fairly notorious for. Is this just a distinction that doesn't mean much, or is it a real distinction?
Thank you, Nelson. To make sure I understand the question correctly, you're asking about the difference between the authorized extralegal power and unauthorized extralegal power?
Yes, although I'm wondering whether it's quite the same to call a delegated power to make binding regulations extralegal in the same sense that it's obviously accurate to say that the prerogative power is extra legal.
So I If the suggestion is that there's a difference between the two, I would fully agree, although perhaps not to the full extent. When there's authority from the legislative body, then at least they're not going off on their own to be making law. And that has provided, you know, some assurance. We're told that administrative power is delegated. But as we both know, much administrative power, much rulemaking and interpretation has taken place without full authorization. And agencies often strain to expand their power, and that seems particularly worrisome. As it happens, my book argues against both. The argument about extra legal power is about a power to bind with rule, to make rules or to adjudicate not through the law itself, but through other mechanisms. And so even a regulation that is authorized by Congress is extra legal in the sense that it's not binding one through the law. It may be authorized by law, but it's not made through the law. And this actually is an old observation. So Henry VIII's Statute of Proclamations in 1539 authorizes Henry to make proclamations that are binding in the manner of statutes, just like our modern administrative regulations. And it's clearly understood at the time that this, in fact, it's almost expressed that this is a Henry will still be exercising absolute power, but he's doing it with legislative authority. And this problem of delegation gets discussed repeatedly. Most of the 16th and 17th century extra-legal or absolute power had legislative authority, or at least hints of such authority, which then got strained. So they're in the same position we are. Nonetheless, it was an attempt to bind people, not through the law, but through other mechanisms, in that sense, extra-legal. And this is why, ultimately, the Star Chamber and the High Commission get abolished. Both of them have at least some legislative authority in the 17th century, and both of them try to run a little bit beyond it. But regardless, it's viewed as a power to bind people, not through their elected legislative body or through the acts of judges, but through other mechanisms. So, yes, there is a difference, I agree. But nonetheless, all of it seems to me extra legal power. All of it is an attempt to bind people through mechanisms other than law.
Let's go to our next caller. We've got six questions pending right now at this point. Let's take another question.
Yes, thank you. How did the constitutional lawyers, and in particular the courts, miss this end run around the Maginot line of the Constitution?
Good question. It may vary from person to person. I think many came to believe the progressive ideals, and many increasingly in law school studied the Prussian vision of extra-legal power, and so they thought it was legitimate. They also came to believe in the living constitution that, you know, everything has to be modernized, and they self-consciously repudiated history as a source of insight, in this case about the dangers. But there was more than this going on, and it actually gets to the history of the living constitution. Nowadays, many people justify the living constitution as something that is just a response to needs, and because judges come to see the light and people accept the judicial opinions, there's something like consent, even if an informal mode. But in fact, that's not always how it happened, and one of the more interesting things I found was that, in fact, living constitution arguments were often accompanied by threats. The history of the threats against the judiciary has yet to be fully written, and I could only touch upon it briefly. But FDR was not the first one to threaten the court. In fact, he was copying what his uncle had done a few decades earlier. The 1912 election is largely debated on the question of how much the judges should be threatened to go along with administrative power. And so if one looks at the period from about 1906 up through somewhere in the middle of World War I, one finds one progressive after another making threats against the courts, threatening them with removal, with overturning their opinions. Some books have entire chapters devoted to theorizing about how you can successfully threaten the courts to keep up with the times. And so rather than think about this in terms of living constitution, I think we have to go back and understand what that really meant. And to my mind, precedents that arise out of threats and in an atmosphere of threats against the courts should not be considered binding. There's something very disturbing about this history.
Adam, you want to take another question from the audience?
Sure. How about one more, and then I've got a couple.
Okay, we've got five questions pending at this point.
Oh, okay.
Let's go to our next caller.
Good afternoon. This is Mike Doherty. I really can't wait to read your book. It's pretty much my life. I'm dealing with the Federal Trade Commission and an administrative court right now. I'm the CEO of LabMD and a member of the Federalist Society. Two quick questions, and then I am driving, so I understand you probably need to mute me right away. But first of all, I believe the FTC is very aware of this process and is intentionally using their powers to develop common law, especially with Julie Brill and how she operates and what her goals have been within data security. And as a side note, my experience on this, if you could comment on this, is that I find almost all the lawyers that are not involved in common law right now in D.C. with very distinguished careers are just stunned at the process we've had to go through. For example, the ALJ does not get to see the motions to quash, the motions to dismiss. Everyone we wanted to subpoena, the FTC's had to sign off. Part of what I'm doing is writing about this so people can see this. Do you find people in the world of law and outside the world of business as incredulous about the existence of this today as I do? Thank you so much.
Thank you. Yes, I think most people don't quite get what's going on. And when they learn about it, they are rather astonished. In fact, I think most lawyers and even most academic experts in administrative law don't really understand the depths of what's happening. And I therefore think it's wonderful that you're writing up your experiences. It actually would be very important for everybody listening to this to think about whether you've had interesting experiences which would reveal the texture of administrative adjudication and rulemaking and that you could share with people. And because most academics studying this go to one agency and then they know they have a somewhat sanitized vision of what their agency does. They see it from above and think that it's legitimate. They rarely see it from how it feels below, and they have little sense of the overall sweep of administrative power across agencies. So we really do need more information about this. The agencies, it seems to me, self-consciously stretch their powers. In fact, it was Prussian theory and repeated by early American progressives that agencies should stretch their power. If there's a need, you need to go beyond the legislative authorization. And the theory was that the primary authority in a country is not the people, but the state. And so the state is the best judge of what the state should do. Constitutional law, as James would put it, comes from above, not from below. So with that perspective, they felt fully justified. And that attitude, even without the theory, is still evident today. And the way this actually works out, for example, in administrative adjudication with ALJs, is particularly disturbing. You know, they're called administrative law judges. These aren't judges. These are just executive officers who are stepping outside their constitutional bounds. What's more, they shouldn't be called judges because they don't really act like judges. The Administrative Procedure Act and all sorts of academics go out of their way to explain that ALJs are really just like judges. Not really. They have all, you know, there's all sorts of inequalities that really tilt the board in favor of the agency and against the person hauled before it. And this includes powers to summon people, powers to get testimony. It includes even the burden of proof. And then, of course, even when you get up to a court, it said, well, the courts will review this. You get up to a court, but the courts show deference, thereby, in fact, showing systematic bias in favor of the government and against Americans. Now, how that's consistent with due process of law, I don't know. At any rate, I go through a lot of this in the book, trying to spell out in detail the way this is really a tilted game. Thank you.
Adam, did you have a question you wanted to ask, or should we stick with the audience?
Oh, these audience questions are terrific. Let's just stick with this.
Okay. If you'd like to join the queue as an audience member, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got four questions pending. Let's take another call.
Thanks so much for a great discussion. You know, in terms of the actual playing out of how this has developed over the decades, it just seems to me there's such a flood of administrative law that is coming so fast from so many different federal departments. It just doesn't seem like our constitutional order is really prepared to address it. You know, it's sort of like plugging a hole in the dike or trying to fight back an ocean. So I'm just wondering how there's the, you know, the theory of it, but how can the administrative law be effectively fought over when it is so much more adaptable than our election cycle? That's my main question.
Thanks. That's a very real problem. And it's, you know, it's disturbing to look backwards, because when you think about the English spent nearly half a century before they succeeded in defeating prerogative or administrative power. And of course, many other countries on the continent did not succeed. Their attempts to limit it were pushed back and crushed, actually. Certainly by the mid-19th century, any pushback was largely over. So we don't want to be in that position. Now, there is some reason for hope. The reality is that administrative law traditionally only affected corporations. Now it increasingly affects individuals, and they feel it. And so many Americans who never understood what administrative power was now get it. They now feel it in their own lives. And that is a very, very good first step. You know, if you think about what matters, it's not just litigation and it's not legislation. What ultimately matters are the sentiments of the people. And simply by talking about the problem, I think we can do a lot. That's why one of the goals of my book is really just to get the conceptual problem out there and get the right language out there to stop using the legitimizing language of law for this. These aren't judges. It isn't administrative law. This is just mere power, mere command. And it's extra legal. And the sooner we begin to use the right language and begin to talk about the problems, then there is, I think it's possible to have some very real pushback. Now, how does this happen in practical terms? My book only begins to touch on that, but there are a lot of possibilities out there, and we don't really know ahead of time which one will work. But, you know, many judges have some disquiet about this. They don't know quite what to do about it, but they're a little rattled by it. And that may be one start. In the states, there's opportunity for pushback. And even in Congress, there's a little bit of hope, although I wouldn't place my bets there. But ultimately, what matters is the conceptual problem. Once one understands this problem correctly and persuade other people to understand it correctly, the rest will follow. And that's why I think this teleforum is so important. Thank you.
Dean, can I interject one question at this point?
Sure, of course. Of course, go ahead.
Well, this latest discussion brings to mind recent developments, and Philip, you might not have an opinion on this, but I'm just curious if you do. There's been talk in the news the last few days about members of Congress pushing back against the administration's assertion of executive power through a lawsuit brought by a House of Congress, formerly in federal court, against the president. Do you have any considered opinion on this approach?
Well, I would love to have an opinion on it, but since I don't, I haven't read that. I've been on vacation, and I'm in a cabin in the woods, so I actually don't know much about it. However, it sounds intriguing, and I'm going to go look it up. The reality is that I think too often this has been treated merely as a matter of law to be decided by judges in relatively narrow range of suits by affected industries. And there are many, many other avenues to dealing with this. And if this is one such, sounds great. But the details of it, I can't comment on because I just don't know. But it sounds fun.
We're speaking with author Philip Hamburger. The book title is Administrative Law Unlawful. Let's take another question from our audience.
Hi, this is Bill James with JPOD. Thank you very much for this. We're going to start building solar-powered transportation networks in Secaucus, New Jersey shortly. The town recently passed a law granting access to rights of way. We have been fighting the federal government and the state governments for some period of time. A similar network was built in Morgantown, West Virginia, as a solution to the 1973 oil embargo. Would you be interested in helping guide this on how we fight administrative law to allow innovation in transportation, much as happened with communications after 1982? Thank you.
Well, I'm flattered that you think I can be helpful. And if you want to contact me, you'll find my email at the Columbia Law School website. I doubt that I'm going to get involved in the particular case, but I'm happy to discuss it generally with you. It seems to me that we all should be at least trying to help where we can with other people's administrative law problems. The danger is that if one fights alone, well, you die alone. And it's across different industries and across different walks of life, there has to be a sort of common cause here. So please get in touch. And what I can do, I don't know, but I'm happy to talk about it.
Thank you.
And this is Dean Reuter. I point out that Adam White is a member of our practice groups. He practices law in this area with Boyden Gray and Associates here in Washington, D.C., so I'll give that as an answer to that question as well. Still four audience questions pending, so let's take another call.
Yes, this is Bill Severson in Seattle. I'm trying to conceptualize your analysis here in kind of traditional administrative law terms. And as I see it, I mean, you've got rulemaking and adjudication. And to the extent rulemaking is an agency's effort to rationally elaborate a statutory delegation, it's hard for me to conceive of that as if that function is performed legitimately as being outside the scope of proper executive authority. And similarly with adjudication, to the extent that that is an agency's attempt to fairly and rationally and apply and carry out its executive functions, it's hard to argue that's somehow outside the scope of proper executive function. So if you take those two things, it seems to me that perhaps what you're talking about is two problems that I would say are, one, the specificity of the legislative delegation, that these broad delegations of authority that provide huge amounts of discretion are troublesome. And then secondly, with respect to adjudication, it's amazing but true, I think, that the U.S., although the Constitution gives the entire judicial function to the Supreme Court and inferior courts, what the judicial function is has never been addressed by the courts. And it seems to me part of your argument would be that administrative law is taking on judicial functions. So I wonder if you could comment on whether that kind of conception is totally at odds with your analysis of this or whether it fits with it. Thanks.
So beginning with your last point, yes, I fully agree that the danger here is that the executive, or in some case even private bodies, are taking on judicial power and often legislative power, which is not the power allocated to the executive branch, let alone to private so-called independent agencies. So getting back to your earlier point, the question is really whether or not these regulations or adjudications carrying out congressional delegations are really proper exercises of executive power. And that seems rather doubtful. If executive power is not the power to bind through rulemaking or through adjudication in particular cases, but rather just carrying out the force of the government, there's a tendency, I think, that has been bred into us over 100 years of administrative lawmaking and adjudication to come to think of this as really something that is normal, that a body of government that has all the legislative powers can give them away to somebody else, or that a body, Congress, that does not have judicial power can somehow delegate or give away the power of the courts to the executive. There's no reason for thinking that this is constitutional. In fact, quite the contrary. Even if this binding power of the executive is delegated by Congress, that doesn't mean that the regulations or law or the adjudication of the acts of a court, they're extra legal. They are attempts to bind Americans not through law and not through the acts of courts, but through other mechanisms. And it therefore doesn't matter really whether this delegation, this gets back to Nelson Lund's argument, or question, sorry. And yes, we may feel a little better if there's delegation, but actually, that's not the most relevant point. The most relevant point is that the executive is exercising a power that doesn't belong to it. And frankly, statutes cannot rewrite the Constitution. They can't change what the Constitution does. So I appreciate the sense that perhaps some of this could be regular and appropriate if delegated by Congress. But in fact, that doesn't solve the constitutional problem or the danger. I mean, think about, let's just play a game here, sort of intellectual game. Imagine that all administrative power is fully delegated, that Congress really came up to the task and authorized the agencies to do all that they do. Would that make one feel better about this? No, because one's being bound by rules and adjudications that come from non-representative bodies and from bodies who are not judges exercising judgment about the law. Independent judgment about the law. So that's not very satisfying. And in fact, it creates a profound structural problem because many people say, well, don't worry, Congress forms a democratic limit on administrative power. Congress will pull back on the administrative state when it gets out of hand. But that's not so clear, notwithstanding the interesting suit that Adam mentioned. The reality is that Congress over the past century has increasingly just thrown up its hands and let the agencies do more or less what they want. And that's not a surprise because there's a shift of power from Congress to the agencies. It's said that Congress controls the agencies, but it may often be the other way around, right? If you're a congressman seeking to get reelected, one of the things you worry about is what the agencies are doing in your district. Are they distributing goodies in your district? Are they constraining people in your district? And so the agencies can, in a sense, control Congress through their distribution of benefits and their control of binding power. And this is exactly the problem, by the way, that was noticed by Prussians in the early 19th century when they said, look, we have an elected legislature, but what good does that do us when the legislature gets controlled by the administrative state? So I think we have a profound structural problem that eviscerates all the alleged benefits of delegation and congressional oversight. Thank you. Good question.
All right. Let's go to our next audience member.
Hi, this is Derek Wilcox from the Mackinac Center Legal Foundation. I had seen a recent case out of the D.C. Circuit where they struck down the delegation of rulemaking which had been given to Amtrak. They struck it down on the basis that this was a private entity that was given rulemaking power. And I believe the Supreme Court has granted cert, so we'll hear this. And I haven't been a court watcher on these issues until recently. And I was wondering if there was any reason to believe that at the Supreme Court there was a chance of at least a modest limitation on delegation here, or if perhaps the court might even go broader than the question presented by the D.C. Circuit.
Thank you. It really would be amusing, wouldn't it, if the court held that Amtrak can govern us. Amtrak can scarcely govern its own trains. This is, even with massive subsidies, they're still pretty lame. So they are now a substitute for Congress. That's going to be quite funny. But on the question of what the court will do, I would defer to Adam on this. I'd be interested in Adam's opinion.
Well, I honestly don't have any prediction on which way the case is going to go. For everybody's reference, the case is cert was granted, I believe, last week. The case is called Department of Transportation versus Association of American Railroads. It comes from the D.C. Circuit. There's actually a couple of issues that were raised by the cert petition, the government cert petition. There's the question of non-delegation to a private entity, but there's also the underlying question of whether Amtrak is, for these purposes, a private entity or a government entity. And so there's a lot of interesting issues in the case, it should make for an interesting case in the Supreme Court.
Can I throw in another word here? It's this whole question of what is an independent agency and whether there's private lawmaking is actually very interesting historically because it reverts right back to the Middle Ages. One of the striking things about the Middle Ages is that all sorts of lawmaking and judicatory power gets disseminated out into semi-official but also semi-private bodies, leading to essentially legal chaos. And one of the great achievements of the 16th century was to centralize that lawmaking power in Parliament. So I think this is a very important case, and it'll be very interesting.
We've got about 10 minutes left, still a handful of callers, so let's take another question.
Hi, this is Jeff Shapiro. I'm a lawyer in D.C., and I practice in the FDA regulatory space. And your thesis is very interesting. I just downloaded your book to my phone, and I look forward to reading it. I have a couple of questions. I want to point out an interesting development in the FDA area, which, you know, would be interesting to hear your thoughts. There's been an explosion of software, medical software, and technically it fits the very broad definition of a medical device. But FDA can't possibly regulate it all, and they're still trying to figure out how it should be regulated. And there's an interesting interplay going on between Congress has some bills floating around to kind of remove some software from FDA's jurisdiction, but FDA is also sort of issuing guidances trying to show that it will be an easy regulator and it will be a sensible regulator and excluding products. And they even issued a guidance recently where they literally said they're not going to enforce a regulation that they just issued a few years ago relating to medical software. So the agency issued a regulation and then issued enforcement guidance saying that they're not going to enforce their own regulation, which is kind of an interesting administrative law development. And I guess my question for you is whether, you're saying everything should proceed by statute. So in the area where there's pre-market review, are you saying we can't have pre-market review? Because that really, it's hard to imagine how Congress could oversee that process. So that's my question.
Thank you. I'm actually very interested in the FDA and HHS and how they regulate what essentially is science and speech. And it's led to a lot of censorship, obviously, particularly in academia through institutional review boards. Now, I think you're absolutely right. These agencies, FDA and others, are really like a small child that can't regulate its own sense of appetite. They want what's on their plate, and then look around and see what's on someone else's plate, and they want that too. And like an unruly child, they'll grab anything and stuff it into their mouths. And then, of course, they get a little indigestion later because they're not really up to consuming all that much, in this case regulating all that much, and that's a problem for the rest of us. Now, the FDA is actually an agency that I use as an example towards the end of my book because it nicely illustrates an area in which everybody assumes that you really do need to have administrative power, because otherwise, goodness gracious, we'd all be in trouble. And so the FDA is a good test case for understanding, could one put this in the hands of Congress and the courts? How could one revert back to constitutional-style government? So I think your question is very much in point. And here, statistics are interesting. Just to start with a sense of scale, the FDA does an enormous amount. But when you actually look at, for example, new drugs that they authorize, over the last decade, I think it's on average 23 a year. Now, of course, they're reviewing a large number of others, but then in the end, they authorize 23 a year on average. Now, what does that tell us? Well, it means we still could have an FDA that makes all sorts of inquiries, collects all sorts of information, reaches its considered judgment. And all that I would ask in this book of the FDA is, instead of itself making the decision to license, it just passes this on as a recommendation once a year in a statute to Congress. And then Congress can vote on this up or down. It's pretty easy. You know, the reality is the heads of most agencies are not really experts. There's more expertise in Congress than most heads of agencies. And nothing in my book objects to prior investigation, inquiry, and collection of information, or passing along regulations. All it suggests is the final decision about rulemaking or licensing should be in Congress or in some types of licensing in the courts. Thank you.
We've got a few minutes left. Let's try and get to these final two questions if we can.
Yeah, thank you. My question is covered. Go on to the next one, please.
All right. Thank you very much. Looks like our final question coming up here.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. It's a long-established principle of original understanding that legislative and judicial powers are not delegatable, but executive powers are, so that executives may issue directives to those under their supervision, although not necessarily to those in other departments. And that could include contractors, but it would not include people who are not operatives of the government, non-government actors.
Mr. Rowland, could you speak up a bit? We're having some difficulty hearing you.
Okay, the problem seems to be a Supreme Court decision beginning the process of allowing administrative regulations to be applied to people who are not employees or contractors. And if we were to roll that back and recognize that they do not have that authority, that would be the beginning of the unwinding of the process. Until we set aside that line of precedence, we're not going to be able to move forward in this area. If we do, we have to face the fact that neither Congress nor the courts have the bandwidth to handle all of the decisions that the administrative state has been called upon to make. And that means that all of those functions are going to have to be moved to states or localities and out of the federal government.
Well, thank you. I didn't hear all the question, but I think I got most of it. And if I heard you correctly, you were saying that the right to regulate in the federal government really, the executive right to regulate is a mode of instructing and regulating officers or those working for the government, and I think that's true. And the real danger comes when the government attempts to regulate in a way that binds Americans generally, not simply a matter of instructing officers.
Yeah, actually, the other channel involved is when courts appoint special administrators or masters, whatever they would choose to call them, to as functionaries of the court and make a finding. But then the problem comes in where the court, of course, this could do this for an administrative agency, treats that finding as presumptive and puts the burden of proof on a litigant who might oppose that position.
Right. So
any such finding needs to meet the same burden of proof that a prosecutor would in a criminal or a civil case.
Right. So the question of masters is interesting because masters have long existed at common law, but traditionally they were not allowed to exercise judgment in a case. They merely exercised ministerial functions of collecting evidence and the like in cases that had been analogous to civil law proceedings. And one of the problems with the arguments on behalf of the administrative state is that masters are used as an analogy to justify agencies in doing what masters actually never were allowed to do. So, yes, I think there's very much a problem in these sort of arguments.
Well, Professor Hamburger, we've exhausted the audience questions here. Adam White, let me turn back to you.
Thanks, Dean. Philip, do you have any closing thoughts?
Well, I first want to thank you and Dean for being here and for everybody who's listening in. The reality is that this is, I think, the central constitutional question of our time. And one way or another, all of us need to be more aware of it, more self-conscious of it, and to fight it. Now, how this is going to happen, how administrative power will be defeated, cannot be clear to us ahead of time. But it's precisely through teleforums such as this that we can become more self-conscious about it and begin to recognize it for what it is. And what it is a return to absolute power, in particular a return to extra-legal, super-legal, and consolidated power. And this is exactly what our Constitution, indeed all Anglo-American constitutional law, sought to defeat. So in a sense, we've unraveled the Constitution and we've returned to a pre-constitutional danger. And that's something worth fighting. Thank you.
Dean, since everybody's attention is focused this week and last on the Supreme Court, I just wanted to point out to the audience that in the next term, there's going to be at least three cases that touch on these issues of administrative power and executive power. One was already mentioned. It was the Department of Transportation versus Association of American Railroads case, the non-delegation case. The second is a case also granted about a week or two ago, Perez versus Mortgage Bankers Association, in which the question before the court is, to what extent must agencies go through notice and comment rulemaking before changing an interpretive rule that changes the meaning of a regulation? And the third case I have in mind is called Zivotofsky versus Kerry, and that's an interesting case in which there's a challenge to the President and State Department's decision not to enforce a statute regarding passports for Americans born in Israel. So all three of these are very interesting cases, and the court may well grant cert and more. So next term might be an interesting term on matters of administrative and executive power.
Well, this is Dean Reuter wrapping things up. My thanks, Adam White. Thank you for your participation today. Author Philip Hamburger, thank you so much. The book, Is Administrative Law Unlawful? By Philip Hamburger. And to our audience, of course, thank you for joining, and thank you for your thoughtful questions. A reminder to check the Federalist Society's teleforum page on its website and monitor your emails for our next scheduled teleforum conference call. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.